views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of 55KRC, The Talk Station, and Clear Channel Worldwide.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, the talk station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I'm your host, John Johnston. As always, check out ballisticradio.com and facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening, Mr. Andy Ulrich and Jim Beatty. How you doing, guys?
Really good. Really excited about this show.
Oh, yeah. This one should be cool. Thanks thanks again for last weekend covering for me.
It was fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I even got to call into my own show, which was slightly strange. Anyway, tonight's guest is probably one of the most well-known people in the firearms industry today. Chris Costa is probably best known for the work he did with Magpul Dynamics and their Art of the Tactical Carbine series. Last year, he branched out and started his own company, Costa Ludus. Tonight, we'll be talking a little bit with him about his methodology, as well as his future plans and all sorts of other cool stuff. There aren't too many people who have made as large of an impact on the industry as Chris has, and it's not even with projects he's directly involved in. If you think about how many people have become involved in the shooting sports because of the work Chris has done, either directly or indirectly, it's actually really impressive. With industry partners ranging from manufacturers like Knights Armament, personal favorite of mine, to companies like Adidas or Rock Tape, it's pretty safe to say Chris is influential in the industry. And no one really wants to hear me talk right now, so we'll just get Chris on the line. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, how you guys doing today, John?
Excellent. Thanks so much for coming on the show this evening. I know you had an off weekend and took the time out of your day to join us, so I really do appreciate it.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest. I was knee-deep in about six geo-track trains, so my two-and-a-half-year-old is going to have to manage that himself, so you know what that's going to mean.
No, it'll be okay. So.
No, it'll be completely a train wreck by the time I get there.
My four-year-old's at home wrecking something, I'm sure. For those that aren't aware, Chris, and I know that's not going to be too many people that aren't aware with your background, but for those that have missed it, do you mind going into it a little bit?
Well, I guess the quick version is I joined the United States Coast Guard when I was 17, graduated high school, went right into the Coast Guard 2 months later. After that, spent 12 years with the Coast Guard, primarily as a federal law enforcement officer with them. Mostly counter-drug ops is what we were concentrating on at the time. And deployments ranged anywhere from all over the Caribbean to Eastern Pacific to parts of Albania, Republic of Georgia, Azerbaijan, parts of Africa. So, you know, different regions of the country or different regions of the globe, basically, that people don't realize that the Coast Guard really occupies. Persian Gulf as well. And I think that's the, you know, the oddity, but you know what? That's fine. You know, if people don't realize that, probably even better. So
yeah, that was actually going to be my question is, a lot of people, you say Coast Guard to them, they're like, oh, what, those guys? And there's not really a clear understanding of how dangerous some of those jobs can be. Have you run into that a lot?
Well, I run into the fact of what you just said. I mean, it's an underestimated branch of service, which is fine. I'd rather us, you know, kind of be looked at as, well, just a Coast Guard, because anything more than you do at that point is kind of unexpected. I think for the most part, people don't realize the day-to-day activities that the United States Coast Guard does. Along with the fact that the Coast Guard's been in World War I, World War II, Vietnam. Primarily where I finished up was down in Iquitos, Peru, running the jungles down in South America looking for coke labs. So when you look at the fact that the guys before me were involved with Panama, Bolivia, and then, of course, Peru, Iquitos, and other regions, there's one of these things that we've always been there. Because we either operate under DOD, Department of Defense, or at the time we operated under DOT, Department of Transportation. So when I was conducting operations in the Adriatic, working with the Brits, the Spanish, the Italians, and the Turks, we were there under the Department of Transportation. It's kind of bizarre how they changed their hat for what basically region or mission we are doing at that moment in time.
Yeah, it's just as I started to delve into it a little more deeply, it was really interesting to me just to see how involved the Coast Guard gets into a lot of things. Now, I'm going to try and pack as much information as I can in the evening. What after you got out of the Coast Guard, you worked with AMTI, which was a civilian contractor for the Department of Defense?
No, AMTI stands for Applied Marine Technologies. Their owners, we had two former commanding officers of Naval Special Warfare Development Group, one former CEO of Red Cell. Bill Shepard, the astronaut, worked at our Skunk Works. He ran the whole thing, of course. And I guess ultimately we did a wide variety of things. Specifically, remember after 9/11, you know, the country was really worried about protecting itself. So most of what AMTI was able to kind of do, we had nuclear physicists, we had chem bio freaks, people with a lot more education than I did. But what we also did was counterterrorism for all SWAT teams in America. So Department of Homeland Security would select regions of the country that were high-risk areas. We would go in and teach specifically counterterrorism. Now, a lot of people are like, well, SWAT teams are already trained. Well, they're trained to kick a door on, you know, domestic or, you know, some type of drug raid or felon. What they're not generally geared up for is a hornet's nest of a terrorist element. And remember, this is also at the time where a lot of Tier 1 units were over in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, working for a lot of different people at that moment in time, which means your quick call-up to get a Tier 1 asset, whether justified or not, to conduct operations within the United States, it wasn't going to happen, which meant that you needed a 30-minute or less type SWAT team to go in there, and, you know, that's what the fear was. The fear was a Bethlehem school siege or the theater in Moscow. You know, that whole situation is what everybody feared. So we were doing that in a lot of red team threat assessments. Since the background of the company was pretty heavily involved in Red Cell, they kind of trademarked and coined Red Team, which basically we did the same thing, same doctrine, went in from dairy farms to small airports in Maryland and the D.C. area to malls, every mall across America. Me and a few of the other guys, we also did three Super Bowls. We did Detroit, Miami, and Jacksonville, and worked with those SWAT teams pre-Super Bowl. So, yeah, a lot of people have a different, I guess, outlook as far as I am concerned, because I am more referred to in this industry as a Coast Guard guy. I'm not,
right.
I'm not anything, you know, more than that. You know what I mean? So
it seems like a lot of people make the mistake. You obviously jumped into the public eye with the Magpul thing, the future weapons, and sort of just took off from there. But you were a trainer for a very, very long time before any of that ever came up. So we got about...
Well, I guess one of your questions was, what got me into being a trainer?
Yeah.
So with the Coast Guard operating in certain regions under the Department of Transportation, which... under the Mansfield Amendment, allowed us to go on and still conduct boardings with foreigners as technical observers, but that still gave us an inherent right of everything, you know, that we had under U.S. law as far as self-defense, defense of others, all that stuff.
Right.
I think the side of the house where you start to get real serious about training is when you realize that it's only one or two of you going out with a group of indigenous personnel that ultimately I never trusted. Like,
yeah.
The moment in which you want to become friends with them, you might as well put a bullet in your own face and take the easy way out. But point being is that what makes me serious about training at that moment in time was my own survival. So it was a matter of, well, I've got to train to a certain level myself, because it's probably just me and my partner. We kind of look at it as we might be the only ones that ever make it out of a altercation. Along with training, the foreigners, to hopefully be a force multiplier, and hopefully if everybody is on board and does what they need to do, we actually can be a really good cohesive unit. And
I'm going to cut you off just real quick, Chris, if I can, just because we need to go to a commercial, but we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get back, and I actually want to hear about your new company. Right now, everyone's listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Wealthy and wise, the Steve Perrin Coordinated Financial Planning Studios. This is 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I just got to interrupt Chris Costa to go to commercial, which I'm truly sorry for, but we are back on the line with him. Chris, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Excellent. I'm sorry about that. They're kind of funny about the whole commercials thing. So you were saying the reason why you got into training and why it mattered so much to you was it was kind of the difference between you coming home or not coming home?
At least that was my personal belief. I mean, you either take it seriously or you don't, especially when you're working with a group of foreigners. And the, you know, as far as if you were a normal military unit, you know, an Army or Marine Corps unit, you have a bunch of like-minded individuals that you've trained with on a regular basis conducting operations with those same individuals, which means there's a level of consistency there and dependability there. And when you're dealing with foreigners, there's a level of, I can't trust any of these guys, but I've also got to train them because hopefully we'll get through a circumstance together. So you start taking your individual training extremely seriously, along with the ability to train other people so that there's no mistake in interpretation, especially when you're dealing with, you know, foreign languages and, well, as, you know what I mean, and such.
Right. So you've got you were working with Magpul and left them. You started your own company, Costa Ludus. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you guys do and just what brought that about?
Well, I mean, primarily, it was just one of those things where Magpul provided a good sounding board. They, you know, I think the great thing about, you know, Magpul, when I was working for AMTI, at a certain point, AMTI got bought out by a bigger security company called SAIC. And at that moment in time, some of the contracts that we were working changed, and some of the people that we were working with, I don't want to really name any names, but I will just say that one of the military organizations started lowering their standard, especially when it involved a counterterrorism mission. And if you're going to put guys in harm's way, and you know you're going to put guys in harm's way, and you're starting to lower a standard to get more guys through, that's not exactly what I really want to be a part of, because what people don't realize, especially as trainers, is that we can help people and we can get them killed faster. And there's a certain amount of that you have to take upon yourself, or whether or not you're contributing to the better or the worse. So once I had worked a little bit, did some other stuff, Magpul actually worked a couple projects as a subcontractor for AMTI when I was there, which is where our relationship started. And one night we were talking, as, you know, most guys do, you know, over a couple beers. And, you know, they had said, hey, look, you know, why don't you start a training division? So, you know, I mean, you're talking about breaking away from a company that at that time, I think I was 6 years at AMTI. And, you know, the company itself changed, not that they wanted to, just that the owners, you know, they're former, you know, probably captains, and now they're running a company that went from $100 million company to hundreds of millions of dollars. So it the company grew a little bit beyond what they were having fun with, and so they ended up selling it. And when Magpul offered me that position to start basically my own training division to where I could be in control of it, That was very tempting. And it took, honestly, about 7 months for that to happen. And I finally, after the military organization that we were working for decided to change the standards, I was like, you know what, it's best if I probably leave before somebody else gets hurt or I'm responsible for somebody getting hurt. So I parted ways. And a lot of people don't kind of understand, like, the chain of events that have happened here. So basically, I get hired by Magpul. They give me an opportunity, which I'm truly grateful for, Rich Fitzpatrick, the owner. And we start that division. We immediately determine that we want to get into the DVD side of the house. So we film disc two of Art of the Carving Part One. What we do prior to that is we film a SWAT teaser to try to figure out what I knew I did not want to do, which was like a one-on-one with Chris Costa.
Yeah.
You know, you got to understand that I grew up on the same videos everybody else did in the late 80s, and you'd watch them for 5 minutes, and, you know, you turned it off. It was really horrible. And what I didn't know whether or not it could be, whether or not you could bottle this up or not, was whether you could film a class. So we talked about the concept. We went out. We did the SWAT teaser. That's why you see it's just me. Then we did Art of the Carbine, Part 1, Disc 2, It's Just Me. That was basically going to be a extra in regards to, well, we filmed it, we got it, we think we got the right recipe, so we'll go at it from there. At that moment in time, Rich was talking to Travis Haley, and Travis and I started talking as well. And what basically Rich's thought process was at that time was actually, it'd be good to have two like-minded people to kind of go back and forth on, and that would be a really good synergy. And honestly, Travis and I had a lot in common. We'd been to, ironically, even though he was in the Marine Corps and I was in the Coast Guard, we went to a lot of the same regions. And we had a lot of that same mindset, which was do more with less and better ourselves as shooters. So that's why when you watch Art of the Carbine Part 1, Disc 1, that literally was the first official Magpul class that we ever taught. A lot of people don't know that. They thought we taught for years prior to that video. We literally met each other in a Marriott hotel room officially, and the next day started filming Art of the Carbine. And you got to understand, we both had military backgrounds. So when we filmed Art of the Carbine Part 1, it was kind of like, well, how do you guys do malfunctions? Well, this was what I was taught. Well, this is what I was taught. And we kind of just blended as fast as humanly possible on a freaking video, which was why after we did that video, we both came to the realization, which was, you know what? We don't have to do what the military has done for years with this institutional inertia, which is just like, well, I did it that way, and the guy before me did it that way, so that's the way we're going to do it for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And never excel as shooters.
It was interesting just because a lot of, and from production values to just some of the things that are talked about on that series were just a lot of really different things. And it's funny to hear how, I guess some of that was on the fly. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit, if that's all right, Chris. You've got Costa Lutis now.
Sure.
You're doing consulting and training pretty much with that?
That's correct. And we're doing certain as well. You know, we find involved. Primary is training. You know, we work with everybody from, you know, the military to law enforcement to the average blue-collar worker, as I like to call it, because what I can tell you,
well,
they're not there to play dress. They're not there to play dress up. They are very serious shooters, worried about protecting their families. And as you know, we've seen with Katrina, and as we've seen with the current global climate, so to speak, there's a lot of fear that nobody's going to be there to protect them if something bad happens. And honestly, that's a very prepared approach. Not to be paranoid, but it's a very prepared approach. So when you look at the type of people that come, everybody ranges from, you know, construction workers to computer IT guys to doctors to lawyers to, it doesn't really matter. You'll find all walks of life, advertising guys. It doesn't matter. We all have one common goal, and that is we want to protect ourselves and our family members. So that's who shows up to a Costa Lutis class. You know, you're not going to get a guy, no offense, who dresses up in some crazy motorcycle-looking, you know, camouflage, you know, just to shoot an event. But when else is he going to wear that shit? You know what I mean? It's like, I just said it again. What's his name's bleeping me. But, you know, basically we don't have the type of shooters that want to play dress up. You know, if you want to go play dress up, no offense, go do paintball or go do another activity. But when you want to learn about shooting and defending yourselves, that's what we're all about. So it's more the serious blue-collar worker.
Right. And I'm just going to hope the FCC didn't happen to be listening on that particular 20 seconds of error.
I am only hoping. So.
No, that's cool. That's just my life savings. Oh, no,
what
seriously.
What you can guarantee who's listening is the National Security Agency.
That's true.
And I don't think they have the same authority as the FCC.
That's very true. So we got about a minute and 18 seconds left. A lot of people are interested in what kind of gear you're running. In about a minute, I mean, just pistols first. Anything different than most people are doing? Anything new?
Primarily, you know, for 1911, I run a Nighthawk 9mm because my arms just can't take shooting 45 at the pace that I'm doing every course. And then Salient, Glocks, and M&Ps. Primarily, those are the guns that I run on a regular basis just because of the quality, the accuracy, and the forgiveness in the event that I make a mistake, which is quite often, more than people realize. So.
Right. And you've been playing around with red dot optics on pistols lately, too, as well?
That's true. Red dot optics eventually is going to be a future. There are pros to that particular system, and there are certain cons to that system as well after running it for the last few years. So, you know, everything's give and take, and breaking that system down is, of course, extremely important. And when a lot of the students are shooting a very similar system and are asking for feedback, I have to do my due diligence as an instructor to shoot that system so I can make reasonable comments on it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We'll talk about that a little bit more. I got to go to commercial again. When we get back, we'll discuss equipment some more, red dot optics, all that sort of good stuff. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Brian Thomas, Monday on the Morning Show, Monday Morning Spleen Vent. Dad will be on the phone ranting away as usual. Make sure you're around at 7:05. We'll find out together what's gotten under his skin.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Right now, we're talking with Chris Cost about training, equipment, and if we have a time a little later, probably Epic Beards. If you have any questions for Chris, you can call us at 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. Try and take your calls at the end of the evening. No promises, though. Also, for those listening, if you hear dead spaces, that's because Chris said a bad word. So, anyway, Chris, are you still there?
I didn't say that many bad words.
Well, just two. That I heard. So
I mean, if you can't say something that you naturally do as a human being, and of course the FCC is going to regulate that, that's crazy.
Well,
how does Howard Stern get away with it?
Well, XM radio, no one's listening. I probably can't say that either. Anyway, it's all Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake's fault. Back to shooting and beards and all sorts of cool stuff like that. Just you were talking about red dot optics on pistols and how in the future they'll probably be pretty standard, but right now you're just kind of playing with them so you have an idea of what your students are using?
Well, primarily, that's where it started. And now it's the ability to now have a more simplified and refined sight picture to be able to hit a target at a greater distance is where I really see the red dot payoff. Along with people that have bifocals and have to focus on a target, which is in one focal plane, and then, of course, anything up close, typically sights, of course, not just one but two, they now have to line that up as well. And you'll see sometimes shooters struggle between one focal point and the other, kind of constantly moving their head up and down to verify whether or not their sights are there. When in reality, you take a red dot, you hold it up in the same focal plane as what you're already focusing on, it becomes an object that's in between you and what it is you're shooting at. And, of course, it's not two where you're having to focus hard on the front sight, soft on the rear sight. You're just overlaying it on the target that you already see. So there's a lot of benefits to a red dot system, especially when you start getting out at distance, because where you would normally start to hold higher and holding higher on a target with your front sight and rear sight, typically you're covering up the exact target that you're trying to shoot. Whereas with the red dot, you usually within the window can still see that target and you're aiming above it, which means that you can still see the target and at least know whether you're in somewhat of alignment or not. Now, The red dot does not solve trigger control issues. It doesn't solve fundamental recoil management issues. So you still have to be a good shooter. It's not a, you know, complete system that is going to help you become a better shooter. What it does, I find, is takes a good fundamental shooter and makes him even better until you get that emitter wet, and all of a sudden you start to see what rain does to an emitter that throws a projection on to a lens. And then, of course, that's a drawback, which means you're going to have to rely primarily on your irons as backups.
Yeah, and it seems like I've noticed a lot of people are starting to sort of move to the aimpoint T1s and H1s mounted on pistols. Seems a little bulky. I haven't tried it yet, but I know that some folks are experimenting with those. I'm going to fast forward a little bit, and you were just talking about people wanting to be able to protect themselves and be responsible for themselves in the event of, you know, whatever, zombies, hurricanes, oil riots, who knows. And what I'm curious about is, A, do you think people are training for realistic scenarios all the time? And B, what's the most important skill folks should be working on if they've got the fundamentals down?
Well, I think that in lies your question. For the people that show up to my class, they're there to defend themselves or their families.
Right.
If they're kitted up more than a special operations guy, then probably something's wrong. So if you're showing up wearing complete full kit with body armor and a helmet and, you know, you look like Ninja Force 5, to be quite frankly, I maybe you conduct secret CIA rendition missions, you know, at a certain point in your, you know, medical to construction career. However, the people that show up to my class are there to learn how to shoot to protect themselves and others in the event that something bad happens. So what are they wearing? They're wearing Mountain Hardware, they're wearing Arc'teryx, they're wearing Kools, they're wearing blue jeans, for God's sakes. And what's kind of funny is when a special operation group of individuals show up to a class that I'm teaching and they look over, because that's the way they're dressed, and they point to some guy literally dressed up with the most amazing kit on the planet, and they're like, who is that guy?
Yeah.
Like, who is that guy? You know, they're curious. And I'm like, I think he said he was a foot doctor. And they're like, are you serious? You know what I mean? It's like, it's one of those things where early on, you know, when I was in the Magpul days, you started seeing that. And I don't know if it's just a certain, you know, certain type of crowd, but all that I know is, at least within my courses now, we have serious shooters that are trying to problem solve events that may take place in our lives. You know, right. What are we looking at? A theater where a guy dresses up as, you know, Batman and kills a bunch of people, right? Yeah. We're looking at an IHOP in California where a guy goes in with an AK-47. We're looking at a Starbucks where four armed law enforcement personnel get gunned down. So what you start to see is that those are the people that I'm training.
Right.
And they're training with realistic either concealed carry gear or the certain styles of weapons that are more prominent to the average, I guess, citizen.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I only bust a multicam out if I'm doing yard work, just because that way I don't have to feel bad if I get it dirty, but that's just me. speaking of prominent equipment, and I'm going to segue into AR-15s here because it seems to be a popular rifle in America for some reason. I'm not sure why, since no one needs one. I've got more than a few personally. I guess, how important is buying a quality rifle?
Well, I would say if you're buying, if you were buying like a tennis racket and you were like, well, I want to play tennis, I want to have a little bit of fun, and, you know, so I only want to spend $100 or $120 on a tennis racket, great. It's probably not going to win you Wimbledon, but it'll probably put the ball from where you're located across a net to where somebody else is located for them to return that ball to you. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a firearm that most people are purchasing because in the event that they get to employ it to protect themselves or others, you don't want it to fail you. So this is definitely an arena where every piece of gear you buy on your gun is and better have a purpose and better be reliable. So if you want to go the cheap way out, that's fine. But don't try to include, well, I'm going to buy this to save my or my family's life, and then go, but, you know, I only want to spend $600 on it. Great. Awesome. Good luck there. You know what I mean? So quality is extremely important. You get what you pay for. So when you're looking at brass tacks of I want a firearm to protect me or my family members in the event something tragic actually happens, you need that thing to work. You don't want it to break. And I know a lot of people who show up to the local gun range, they buy a firearm from certain manufacturers, and I really don't want to put those manufacturers down because probably, you know, a third of America that actually has those. And, of course, when they show up to a class, their guns break, and they don't understand why because, you know, they're normally used to clearing three malfunctions within two magazines out on the local gun range. And you look at them like, seriously?
Yeah.
I mean, the only time my gun actually malfunctions is when I'm doing a demo in front of you and I have to physically cause it. I would never accept that. I'd never use that firearm to protect myself or my family. So, you know, it's don't go the cheap way out, that's for sure.
Yeah, it just seems like I don't know. That's a constant argument that I have with people, and I kind of like when I get people on the show to sort of bring that up or try and sneak it in the best I can just to sort of be a jerk and prove that I'm right over and over and over again because I need that affirmation. So, why do you
You're right, John.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. So, going back to the AR-15s, and I guess my question, you see a lot of those in 5.56. That seems to be the most popular caliber. Some people say that's not good for civilian use. Other people are the other side of the argument. Where do you fall on that, Chris?
I fall on it, which is shot placement. It's like the debate of 9mm versus 45.
Right.
Most people can't handle 45. Limited magazine capacity, so therefore, you know, it's a slight problem when it comes to recoil management and capacity. And when people look at things as, oh, well, you know, I want to be able to hit the guy once or twice and stop him, you've already failed yourself.
Yeah.
You've already messed up because you're relying on a bullet or a projectile to do the work for you, whereas when we focus on training, we specifically focus that the bullet will fail you, and it is your job to run it from target location to another, which means accuracy and recoil management. So within those two arenas, it's extremely important. So when you look at 5.56, I don't have a problem with 5.56, but I'm also not expecting to shoot the guy three times and for everything to be okay. I'm expecting to run 8 to 11 rounds on a guy and literally annihilate him because there is nothing defensive about a gunfight. There's nothing defensive about a gunfight. Legally, we use that word in court and say, well, I had to defensively shoot this guy. Let me explain something. First bullet passes over your head, your gun's coming up, and you are literally trying to evaporate that individual who's trying to kill you or your family. So, you know, you start looking at caliber selection. Yeah, you know what? 5.56 is a good caliber. We try to go and increase, from 55 grain to maybe a 75 grain, you know, tap or, you know, a round that Hornady makes or maybe something like a 2.62 round, 77 grain Black Hills. You know, now you have 300 BLK, which is the same bolt group, same magazine, different barrel, that now shoots upwards of 155 grain round that PNW makes. So ballistically, you're putting a bigger hole in somebody, but you're also not dealing with the same type of recoil as you would with a 7.62 by 51 if you ran a larger platform like an SR-25 or an M14, something of a more traditional configuration. But you're also not limited in your mag capacity down to 20. You can still carry 28 rounds in your mag. So really, at the end of the day, is you need a gun that is enough gun, but you also need a gun that you can physically handle. So I find guys, you know, going back to, you know, back and forth a little bit here because it does pertain to caliber, you know, guys want to run 40, they want to run 45, but yet they cannot handle that particular caliber. Handle running a 44 Magnum. Well, I don't run a Desert Eagle in my classes.
Yeah.
One, because it's huge and hideous. Second, because follow-up shots and trying to control and manage that platform, it's just too much. And then don't think just two hands on the gun. You've got to think what happens if you grab your little girl or your kid and you're going to employ that gun with one hand. Can you do it one hand? Whether or not you're grabbing your kid or not, maybe you're injured. Can you do that and be able to get back on target extremely quickly? So both with the 5.56, along with other types of calibers, it's a good caliber that most people can handle. And when you start looking at the ranges of that particular gun, I mean, you know what? When a person's got a bullet in their pelvic girdle, whether they're at 800 yards or not, you know what? They're not the same type of person they were, you know, 2 seconds ago.
Right.
So, yeah, they may not be dead, but they certainly aren't going to be doing any wind sprints anytime soon. So a lot of guys get into these caliber debates of, well, you know, this doesn't have the knockdown. Yeah, you might not have, you know, knocked them down had you shot them in the center mass, but when you shoot them in a pelvic girdle, it starts to destroy their hip joints and their ability. Guess what? Home chicken's not moving on me anytime soon.
Yeah.
So maybe I do have some options, and maybe I do fragment that location, and maybe they can bleed out.
I'm going to interrupt you again real quick, Chris. Just because we have to go to commercial again, but I will get right back to that. Right now, everyone's listening to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station.
Glenn Beck. This will blow your mind. Tomorrow at 9:06 on 55KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. If you have any questions for Chris Costa, call us at 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. Looks like his cell phone finally dumped him, so Eric, the wonderful producer, is going to try and get him back on the line. Unfortunately, you guys are going to have to listen to me talk for a second, so I'll take a call. We've got Ronnie from Forest Park. How's it going, Ronnie?
So good so far.
So what's your question?
I want to know what is the best magazine for AR-15 Bushmaster?
Well, generally what I tend to run, and I'm pretty sure Chris would agree with this, is either the Magpul magazines, the plastic ones, not any plastic one, but the ones that have the Magpul anti-tilt follower in them, or the USGI mags that also have the anti-tilt Magpul follower in them, are kind of handy. So that would be question number one answered. So,
have you ever heard of CAA?
I have. I wouldn't suggest it.
Okay, so, gotcha.
Yeah, no problem. Let's see. We are still trying to get Chris back on the line. It's that whole living out in the boonies thing, or maybe it's the interference from the awesomeness of his beard. But we are, let's see. All right, so we've got Art from Mount Washington has a 1911 question. So, Art, are you there?
Yeah, sorry, I don't have research this question better. I'm sitting in the woods. I don't have access to my computer. But I recall Chris being behind a signature 1911. I believe he was working with either Sig, Fowler, or Springfield.
I don't think it was Sig or Springfield, but hey, we've got Chris back on the line. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, that's correct. Sorry about that, but we're going to have to fire one of your guys there.
No,
it'd be me.
I'm usually the one that hangs up on stuff. So.
Way to go. The beard is not impressed. No, to answer his question, Nighthawk 1911's Nighthawk Custom is the guns that I run currently. So,
is that due yard?
Okay, so you didn't previously work with Sig or Springfield on one?
No, I don't think I've ever worked with Sig. I've shot Sigs, I've shot Springfields, but I've never worked with those guys before.
So, thanks for calling in, Art. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Appreciate you listening.
Keep safe, Art.
Thanks.
So right now, we've got Chris back on the line. Chris, sorry about that again. I will punish someone later. So
with a little bit of mild therapy and maybe a back massage, I might have to work myself through it.
It's okay, man. So right now we got a clear line. If you have a question for Chris, you can call us 513-749-5500 or to all the people listening out of state. Appreciate you listening. You can get a hold of us at 1-800-823-TALK, T-A-L-K. So as far as AR-15s go, what are you running these days, Chris? Yeah, I don't think any of us heard that just because it sounded like the teacher from Charlie Brown. I heard URX rail, which I assume means Knight's Armament. I don't know if we've got a better connection. You there, Chris? Nope, doesn't look like it.
Again.
Yeah, lost him again. So, Well, that's the problem with calling people that are out in the middle of nowhere is it's beautiful out there, but sometimes you can't get a phone line to save your life. He's actually calling back in right now. Thank you very much, Eric. Let's see. Chris.
So primarily you were asking me what type of AR-15 I run, and it's a nice armament with the URX-4 rail, which is their version of the Keymod rail.
Nice. Nice. I haven't convinced him to send me one of those yet, so I'm extremely jealous, but it's also because my beard is not nearly as cool as yours. So as far as we've got about 3 minutes left, plus or minus. sorry about that. We ate some airtime up trying to get you back on. We've got Paul from Batavia. He has a question about 357. Paul, are you there?
Yeah, so I was just wanting to ask the opinion of your guest as a 357 for a personal defense weapon.
Chris.
And now, are we talking 357 SIG or 357 Magnum?
Magnum.
The only thing that I would be worried about is slight over-penetration, so I would really want to make sure that the round that I had expanded as fast as humanly possible. I carry a 357 not for personal defense, but I carry it for bear country out here where I'm at, cats, things like that, wolves. I don't carry it for self-defense only because typically when you're looking at 357, you're talking maybe a six-shooter or, you know, if you're running a 340 PD, you're talking five. Maybe you're running a big boy wheel gun, which is a, you know, plus eight, something like that, that Smith & Wesson runs. So ballistically, there's nothing negative to say about the round. Limited capacity, of course, which you've got to be concerned about, and then, of course, whether or not you can employ that gun with your left hand proficiently as much as your right hand proficiently as well. So good caliber selection, nothing wrong with it.
All right, Paul, I appreciate you calling in. Hopefully that answered your question. Chris, I have an online question for you. As far as the Operation Z that you're putting out, is Volume 3 a work in progress? Or
no, I think they, you know, a lot of what I, you know, what I wanted to ultimately convince them to do was create a, you know, I can't say the beginning of that word, but a you know what hits the fan type video.
Yes.
Series is what we were really wanting. And at the time, remember, there's when you film it and then, of course, when it comes out. And primarily that's what I wanted because I felt like a lot of Americans were focused on this worst-case scenario, especially after they saw Katrina. I mean, if you look at Katrina, Katrina was really interesting because that was within 48 hours of help coming, people turned into animals, complete animals, Wild West, you know, freak show type of deal. And I, as I explained to people, you have good human beings that do the right thing morally, whether there's a law or no law. You have the criminal element, which does obviously conduct criminal activity, generally gets arrested, goes to jail, things like that. And then there's a crazy portion of society that is literally only doing what's right because there is law. And when law disappears, they become animals. And that is a huge number. So, you know, with Operation Z, what was told to me was, hey, look, we can't do one of those videos. It, like, America's not ready to handle it. Well, they weren't ready to handle it when we filmed it, but they're more than ready to handle it now because it's one of the biggest topics across America right now.
And
so
that seems to be something you're talented at, too, is recognizing a need and fulfilling it before everyone else recognizes that it's there. We got about 60 seconds left before the show's over. That time goes quick. Do you have any projects upcoming that you want to talk about real fast?
I think primarily what we want to continue to do is, you know, look at what we're teaching and make sure it's the right thing to do. I've got some different projects that I'm going to be working on the video arena, but I don't want to really go too far into that.
Right.
And I think, you know, with those, it's to give a, you know, different look at certain things that are happening. But
yeah, yeah, and that's the end of the show, unfortunately, Chris. Thanks so much for coming on tonight. Like I said, it goes quick. Really appreciate it. Next week, we'll be talking with former Navy SEAL and president of Trident Concepts, Jeff Gonzalez, about what Chris mentioned early, performance standards and how failure can shape us for good or bad. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next Sunday at 7 p.m. Thanks to Costa Lutis and Chris Costa for coming on tonight, right here on 55 KRC, the talk station.